Welcome, everyone, to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Today is a very, very, very special day. I am live with filmmaker, author, podcaster, screenwriter, Eric Pruitt. Eric writes crime fiction. He writes short stories. He writes flash. He's written on everything from napkins to probably walls and then some, with any kind of device that will produce words. But we're here because Eric created a very special podcast called The Long Dance. In 1971, there was a double homicide of a 20 and a 19-year-old that was left unsolved. It was a cold case. When he and a journalist friend of his were invited by the Durham police to investigate that case. Today, we're talking to Eric about the Long Dance podcast. Eric, welcome back to Authors on the Air.
Oh, thank you very much, Pam. Thank you for having me, always.
I mean, I love listening to you read, and I love reading your books. You are one of our award winners for crime fiction last year from the network. I think you have a great sense of humor. I love all the images that you create, but this is something totally different. This is something that I think was even unexpected to you when the opportunity arose. So will you tell listeners how this cold case homicide came to be yours and Drew's to investigate?
I had written an article in the local paper, and Drew Adamek, who was an investigative journalist who has been, I mean, he's been traveling around the world, and he happened into Durham. And while he was there, he asked if I would be interested in teaming up with him on like a deep dive into something investigative. And I've never done it before. And he said he was looking for a writer, and his thing is researching and field producing. So we challenged each other to go home, each look up five different cases or five different stories that we could kind of deep dive, do a longer style investigative piece. And then we would meet back in a week. About a week later, you know, through my research, I found the Mann McBain homicide from 1971 and realized there was no need to continue looking for four others. This one was the one. And he agreed. And because this story had everything, it was, you know, it was a nursing student and her boyfriend who in 1971 left a Valentine's dance to go down a lover's lane, and they were never seen again. Their bodies were found 2 weeks later. They'd been tied to a tree just over the county line and had been tortured, strangled, and left for dead. I mean, covered with leaves. So it was a horrible crime, and there were no answers to anything. The media had a kind of a lockout from the local police back then, and then it just went cold. But there was a lot of family members that were still wanting questions, answers to questions, just same as we were. So we were privileged to be able to tell this story.
So I know that as investigators for this case, you had a lot more leeway than police would in looking for answers. What did it occur to you at the beginning to create a podcast for this, or were you recording for your own information so when you were going to tell the story, you'd have audio of the story as well?
If you know, that's a good question. We didn't really know what we were going to do. And in fact, one of my greatest regrets in this, probably one of my greatest regrets ever, was that we actually had one interview. Our first interview was with a nurse, and we didn't know we were going to do a podcast. And she gave us so much information about how hard it was to have gone through Watts, and that for Patricia Mann, the female victim, to have made it as she did and then be taken from us, you know, what a tragedy that was, because it was like boot camp. And she described a lot of this for us, and we didn't know what we were doing yet, and we didn't get any of that, because when we finally decided, you know what, one of the most transformative experiences to me receiving a story was when they did Serial. And I've always wanted to do something like that, like you know, This American Life and what they did with Serial.
Sure.
And so we came around to it. We're like, this is a podcast. There's so much more information. There's so many voices to this. that let's do it as recordings. And we tried to get a hold of that nurse, and she didn't want to go on tape. So we lost that interview, and it was always a regret of mine. It's like, I wish we had known just a couple weeks earlier that we wanted to do a podcast, because I would have gotten that really compelling interview.
Do you wish that you had video also, Eric? Would that have made a difference?
I think it would have, but it would have probably made a negative impact. A lot of these people, they were uncovering something that was, that of course has impacted their lives so much. And so it's hard to get people to open up and talk about this painful moment. And I think it would have been harder if there was a video camera and a film crew in the room. We got a lot of what we got because it was just a microphone. In some cases, like when we talked to the primary suspect, I know for a fact he would have thrown us out of his office if there would have been a camera. But a microphone made it easier.
Our friends, S.W. Loudon and Eric Beatner, had you on their podcast called Writer Types, who, by the way, Eric and Pruitt and Eric Beatner and Steve Loudon and I are sitting on a panel at BoucherCon about podcasting.
I cannot wait.
It's going to be so much fun. Oh, my God. Poor moderator. Kate Melman, the moderating, too, with Dan being there. It ought to be interesting. But you sent me some clips from that show. Listeners, these are not edited. These are just random clips. I'm going to play some of those, and let's see what goes on in the long bands.
It was an innocent, sterile affair, but a great place for Pat and Jesse to be together.
Sometime between 11 and 11:30, Pat and Jesse left the dance. They were last seen getting into their car and heading north down Maryland Avenue, presumably toward their favorite spot to go parking in the undeveloped Crowsdale neighborhood. They never returned.
The house mother came up to our room right when Pat didn't check in.
Yeah.
So it must have been, what was Friday night?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock? All right, so by 1:10, she was in our room.
Yeah.
Asking if Pat was there, and from there we went to Gail's room, and then from Gail's room we went to every room.
And they called the police.
And then we
they
called
us
the Durham
hours.
Police.
I am so impressed with the quality of the work that your sound engineer did. So I want you to give a shout out to her because it's really incredible.
Piper Kessler of Velasquez Digital Media. Piper and I have worked on films, audiobooks. Recently, believe it or not, was approached by a production company, Wreak Havoc Productions, who heard the podcast and wanted me to narrate their short documentary about the Charlie Lawson murders in 1929. And they teamed me back up with Piper to record the narration for that documentary, if you can believe that. That's coming out September 22nd. But she's amazing. She's like, I've been fortunate to have met her and be able to work with her the past 5-6 years. So definitely the MVP there.
I want to just let listeners know, if you have questions for Eric about this podcast, The Long Dance, you can call in at 347-633-9609. Eric, other than maybe one line and the opening credits when the podcast begins, episode one, you've written the script for this entire podcast, have you not?
Yes.
It has your voice because I love the way you write, and even though you write about some really hapless criminals and small town ne'er-do-wells, your writing has a very intelligent edge to it. So it was not hard for me to recognize that those were your words. Did you enjoy the writing of this podcast, the scripts for this podcast?
I loved it. I absolutely loved it and would count myself extremely privileged to be able to do it again. I had not written scripts like this before. This was difficult. It was a very challenging process, but I enjoyed every minute of it. It would involve piles and stacks of paper all across my room. I think I have a Snapchat video I saved of just how all these piles will accumulate while I'm doing this. I have to transcribe all of the interviews. I already have a narrative in my head, and I have to find the moments in the interviews that kind of back up that narrative. But as soon as I let these people speak for themselves, it changes the narrative I originally had. So I have to do this mix between narrating and letting these people actually speak the story that was very organic. It was, like I said, very challenging, but a lot of fun. And so I loved the experience and want to do it again.
I was reading your website again because, you know, you update it actually not, you know, frequently enough for it to be new to me when I go to it. You really don't care about how a story is told. You just want it to be a great story. In other words, if it's film, if it's podcast, books, articles, it really doesn't matter to you the format, does it?
I think the format is important to the story that's chosen, but
right.
I won't stop. You know, like if it was obvious this story needed to be told in podcast form. And mm-hmm. so I'm all about following what the story needs. There's some stories that are obviously short stories. No one would be interested in following me for 80,000 words on particular narratives. So I try to tell it in three. And there's some things that are just obviously a film. So I like to try my hands, you know, and see what the story needs and try to follow that.
And I want to also mention that in October you have a new book of short stories called Townies. And will you share what that book is about, please?
Absolutely. Thank you. It's a collection of stories. We're calling it Townies and the other stories of Southern mischief. So over the past 5 years, I guess since about 2012, started writing and started publishing short stories. And I think the most common theme is that they are Southern. I think in huge swatches of the United States, you know, being Southern has kind of gotten a little stigma. And so I like to show that, hey, not everybody with an accent like mine is an idiot. So I like to kind of turn that Southern stigma on its head and show people that there's good folks out there, but there's also bad folks.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories, and I actually heard you read it in Tampa, is Knackered. And at that time, you kept saying, I don't know if I'm ever going to tell this story again. That's what you said, because we recorded it live from north of our Tampa. And you said, I may never, this may be put away for good, but I'm glad it's in the book. So congratulations on that. Polis Books is publishing
you.
That. It'll be out in October. I want to go back to the story and play some more of the clip that we were listening to and then comment on it, please.
It was an innocent, sterile affair, but a great place for Pat and Jesse to be together.
That's the same one. Sometime between 11 and 11:30, Pat and Jesse left the dance.
I stopped it in the middle.
They were laughing, getting into their car.
Well, let's listen
and heading north down Maryland Avenue, presumably toward their favorite spot to go parking in the undeveloped Crowsdale neighborhood. They never returned.
The house mother came up to our room right when Pat didn't check in.
Yeah.
So it must have been, what was Friday night?
I have to tell you that I love listening to this woman talk because it really does harken back to the early 70s when she talks about a house mother. And
mm-hmm.
so it really adds to the narrative. You're right about that. So let's go ahead and turn the sound back up and listen to a little bit more.
Her mom and I were sitting at the kitchen table eating, and her sister Ada came over, and she said, I've got some news. She said, something's wrong. And she said that Pat was missing, that she had gone to the dance, that she didn't show back up at the dorm. It was a Saturday morning. My father called our apartment and said,
is Jigger there, because he thought, well, maybe he changed his mind and decided to spend the night in Durham and not drive back to Pittsburgh. I said, no. I said, why? Daddy says, well, you know, we're trying to find out where he is. It seemed like that day went on forever.
Let me ask you something, Eric. When you spoke to the families, did you speak to them in like any type of an order when you knew who you wanted to talk to? Because I would imagine editing this podcast presented its own challenges. You want to hear both family side of when they found out their loved ones were missing.
We were fortunate to have the blessing of Carolyn Spivey, who was the female victim, Patricia Mann's best friend and cousin. They'd grown up together. And she's an amazing woman. And you can hear the pain in her voice throughout this.
Yes.
You can hear, you know, the pain and the love and the anger. And you can, you know, so she's a great storyteller on her own. And she pretty much single-handedly carried the flame for the justice for Patricia Mann by herself, because this family had just been through heartache after heartache after heartache, not just the loss of Patricia, but other things as well. So they were tired of reporters coming to their door and knocking on them and et cetera. But Carolyn, through working with Major Tim Horn of the Orange County Sheriff's Office, decided to take on the mantle and figure out who did this. In speaking with her, she let us know. She said that there are certain family members that it's just too much for them, and they don't want to dig this back up, and they don't. They want to see something happen, but they could I please not approach them. So after working with her, we just let her tell us who to talk to, who we won't be picking off a star by scab by calling out of the blue, and just followed her instructions. So. Too. We were fortunate to get several people that wanted to give their stories about losing their loved one.
Let's listen to a little more.
I thought something bad wrong. I thought something has gone very bad wrong.
So then everything's kind of black for me. I just remember I remember that at some point her roommate Gail went out searching, and Gail knew that she was going to go parking. So Gail went to that place and found her car. So that kind of got the police to looking. So then you go into this feeling of, okay, well, they're not dead, though. Maybe somebody took them, maybe something. You just could not want to believe that they were dead. And then, of course, it was on the news, and then it just went crazy.
Jesse's 1968 Ford Cortina was found in Pat and Jesse's favorite makeout spot, in a little cul-de-sac tucked inside an undeveloped neighborhood running alongside Crowsdale Golf Course. Known as the Crowsdale Motel, it was a popular parking spot for teenagers. And that morning, the dark-colored sedan stood out, left alone with the doors still locked.
It wasn't the Durham police who found the car, but rather two carloads of nurses, dispatched when no other help arrived. The nurses pushed open the tiny vent windows to unlock the car. Inside, they found their jackets, her purse, a pair of pantyhose, neatly folded and tucked beneath the passenger seat, but no sign of their classmate. Her boyfriend.
It was just crazy. It was a Saturday, and so the whole family just gathered at my aunt's house, and we were just waiting for news and no news.
When you were speaking to all these people, doing these interviews, did you uncover things the police did not know immediately?
I know that throughout the process, there were some things that we were able to share with the investigator, the current investigator, Tim Horn, that he may not have come up with. I know, you know, our mandate with them was that Major Horn said that there were three suspects that had never been ruled out. And he said if we were going to look into one, he wanted us to look into all three equally. so that we weren't just doing a hit piece on one man. So if we could prove mm-hmm. that one person did it, he wanted us to prove that the other two didn't, you know. And he asked us to tell our story that way. And we took a challenge. So we took each of the three suspects and told as much about them as we could dig up. Well, in some of these, you might call lesser suspects, we were able to actually dig pretty deep. And in the case of one of them was deceased. We found their next of kin and who had actually been looking for his father his entire life. Father left him when he was two, went in and out of prison, and et cetera. He's detailed in episode 4. We're able to approach this next of kin who'd never known his father. And since I had a file of information I dug up on his father, I said I'd exchange it to him for two cheek swabs. So we were actually able to get DNA from one of those suspects and give it to Orange County and so that they could test it against the DNA on the road.
Wow. It's pretty heavy duty. You know, that's a long – and, of course, technology has come a long way, too. You're talking about DNA that there was no such thing at the time. How did the police – first respond to this double homicide, Eric?
In 71 or mm-hmm. when we approached them?
No, in 71.
In 71, at first it was a missing person because Pat and Jesse went missing in Durham. And so they assigned a detective to it. Now, the detective they assigned was Sergeant Tim Bowers, and this would be his first case. Unfortunately, it was a relatively inexperienced investigator, but everything points that he was partnered up with one of his superiors, who was more seasoned. However, they were assigned a missing persons case, and that's how they were treating it. Since it was two lovers that had disappeared, they kind of thought that maybe they had eloped, or they weren't really missing. That they were just two lovers out on a romp or whatever. So they didn't take it seriously immediately, but after a couple of days, they started to realize, hey, man, this is something. The biggest problem in this investigation is that when it became a homicide, it was because their bodies were found 400 yards over the county line. And so now you involve another law enforcement agency. And it's in 1971, right. They couldn't exactly text each other and ask for help. So technology was against them communicating, but also so was a little bit of competition. Everybody kind of wanted to bring it home. And within no time, you involved, alongside the Durham police and the Orange County sheriffs, you also had Durham sheriffs, the FBI, and for reasons we get into pretty deep, the Department of Motor Vehicles for a time was the investigative body looking into this double homicide, which is pretty crazy. But you have six law enforcement agencies all wanting to bring this home, not working with each other. And the placement of those bodies just over the county line ended up being kind of like the thing that hamstrings everything.
Yeah. The call-in number to speak to Eric is 347-633-9609. Eric, of course, there are 8 episodes completed in this podcast or 9. I can't remember which. 8
it's
episodes,
eight.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me what the last episode is about, because these episodes are long and we don't have 8 hours to play them, but you spent a long time doing this investigation. Long time. You spent a couple of years, maybe a year.
I think we last counted at 20 months, and we're still going.
Yeah,
20 months.
And you're still going.
Plus.
So the last thing that you and I talked about with this long dance crime case was that the ropes that were found bound around the victims were being sent for a very specific kind of DNA analysis to see if there was blood or any other genetic material on the ropes in the event that the killer or the kidnapper or both bled or sweat or anything like that. What happened when they got the results back?
It wasn't the greatest news. It was sent in. We sent it in. They used this machine called the MVAC. There's only 40 of them in the United States. Guilford County had one, and they were kind enough at the request of the Carolinas Cold Case Commission. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Joe Kennedy. They were kind enough to lend us the use of the MVAC. So it's kind of like basically like a big shop vac kind of that will soak your item in solution. In this case, is a rope. So this 47-year-old piece of rope is soaked in the solution, and then it sucks back up into the machine, which will then process all the DNA that's on the rope. Now, unfortunately, even though the crime scene was handled expertly and professionally back in 1971, they weren't looking for DNA back then. So Right. It wasn't, you know, it is a 47-year-old piece of rope that wasn't necessarily preserved for DNA. So over that amount of time, what was left on the rope when we tested it in April of 2018 was not enough for a conclusive identification. They were able to say that there were three profiles on that rope. One was female, one was male, which we can assume was the victim, but there was another male present on the rope. So they got him on that rope. He's on that rope, but it's just, can it be pulled out? Now, since the podcast has come out and a couple of news reports specifically by Sarah Kruger of WRAL, there's been a lot of people that have reached out to Captain Horn, Major Horn. He's been promoted. Reached out to Major Horn, including this one fellow from the Netherlands who literally wrote the book Untouched DNA, and they're offering their services to see if their technology isn't better. But I mean, let's face it, technology's gonna get better. It always does. So
sure.
Major Horn likes to call it a little race. You know, it's a race between advancing technology and the suspect's advancing age, and see who's gonna win.
You have in your mind someone who you think you're within a close degree of certainty who committed this crime. Is there a sense that you need to go back and talk to him again?
I'd love to talk to him again.
Do you?
I'd love
think
for him to
that,
hear a podcast. I'd love to talk to him. Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that he? I mean, you've spoken to him already, you know, as one of the three, obviously, the one guy you couldn't talk to because he was dead. But do you think, having had a conversation already, that he has any remorse?
I don't think he does, no. I think he sleeps just fine at night. We're digging him up, which we do in episode 6. This isn't his only... issue. This isn't his only brush with the law or brush with violence, particularly violence against women. And so I think that, I don't know how he rationalizes it or how he even cares, but I think he sleeps just fine at night.
Do you think he is both kidnapper and killer, or just one or the other?
I'm going to answer that kind of in the long way, because here's kind of what happened since the podcast has come out, is that people have come forward. Throughout the podcast, we talk about this incident, and we call it the Duke Forest incident, where we had always heard about a similar style abduction that had happened, but we couldn't get any details on it. And a lot of law enforcement agencies just don't keep the records from 1970. And if they did, their paper, you can't just find them. You need a date. You need names. You need some more information.
Right.
We've never had it. After with the publicity of this thing, an old investigator came out and was like, you know what? I've always felt this had something to do with this 1972 attempted abduction in Duke Forest, which we'd been looking for. And Major Horn talks to him, gets all the information. And it turns out, yes, there's something just around the corner, literally around the corner from where the bodies were found, a very similar style abduction. Somebody takes two teenage lovers off of a Durham Lover's Lane, transports them just over the Orange County line, and is prepared to do them harm. In this case, put the man in the trunk. And he refused. He defended his girlfriend by fighting off the attackers who was holding a gun on him long enough to let the woman get away, and then he knocked the gun into the dark, and he got away. And the next day, they gave a sketch to the authorities. Now, because we're dealing with different law enforcement agencies, they didn't necessarily communicate and draw the dots between the crimes back then, but Major Horn has it now. And his belief is, and mine, is that when you're listening to these people, these survivors of this 1972 incident, you're basically listening to what happened in 1971. And if we don't have what we need to get this guy for 1971, you know, Horn believes he can get him for 1972. And it's just the same as, you know, Horn always compares it to, you can't get Al Capone for murder, but you can get him for tax evasion. You know, if you get him for 72, you get somebody for 72, likely you got him for 70.
Wow.
So that's my answer, is I think that, you know, I would have come up with some other imaginative scenario until we heard the story in 1972. And once we heard it, I do believe, you know, because we have that composite sketch that was drawn. We have that and we can compare it. And I do think that, yes,
the person
in 1971 was probably kidnapped.
You've seen the composite sketch from 1972. Is there something similar to this person who you believe to be the perpetrator? Is there some type of photo of him at that time that you can compare it?
Yes.
And it's your belief it's the same person?
It's my belief that their faces look exactly the same, and the height, weight, description, accent, voice, demeanor, etc., is exactly the same.
Wow.
So
now, let's continue on that vein. Have there been other incidences that lead you to believe that this is a serial killer or abductor? Has anything ever happened similarly in the years since?
Yes, and we mentioned that one specifically in episode 6. It was exactly the same thing, except it was two male hippies aggressively hitchhiking, and we actually tracked down one of those male hippies who told the story. And that's the whole reason our prime suspect even gets on the map, is because this hippie identifies him as the man who pulled over, said he was a cop, flashed his gun, and told this hippie to get in the back seat of the car, and he wouldn't do it. After the attacker drove away, the hippie wrote down his plate number and then later picked him out of a photo lineup. And that's how this guy even gets onto the radar, which would have been 2 years after the murder and 1 year after the 1972 attempted abduction. So if it wasn't for this hippie coming forward to make that phone call, this dude may have never been on the radar.
Jeez, God. It's crazy. I mean, you know, Durham's not a small town, but it certainly isn't a bustling, hustling city the way something like New York or L.A. or Miami is, you know.
Thank goodness.
And yeah, right? But you've got essentially a serial criminal living in that town. And I
we
know
and this...
it's a cliche. They all come to Florida, which is where he lives now, right? It's a cliche, but it's true. Hello, calling all police and law enforcement agencies. If you're looking for a bad guy, just come down here to Florida, because chances are he's hiding
down
there.
That's where they make them.
I'm telling you, that's where they all come down here.
When I go to BouchaCon, I'm going to catch me one of those Florida men.
I'm telling you. It's probably a stone's throw away too, and I know the area because you and I have talked about it. We're not going to tell anyone because I don't want them, you know, trying to beat down somebody's door. But wow, okay, what's happened with the Long Dance since all this has come out? I can imagine that. First of all, true crime buffs have got to be in Nirvana listening to this, because it's so well done and it's so well produced. The story is so compelling. What do you want to see happen, Eric?
I want to, you know, if it's my birthday, Christmas, like I had anything I want in the entire world, it would be that, you know, someone, me, Major Horn, some other law enforcement office, you know, someone is able to get somebody for what they did to Pat and Jesse. So that's number one above all, you know, what I want. Down the line, on down the line, but not too far behind it, I would like to do this again. You know, I got a taste. I had so much fun. And so now, as a few offers have been coming in, I'm very fortunate to be able to just kind of take a look at everything and see what I want to do next. But I really want to do it again. I enjoyed every bit of this process. So
now, has your co-investigator has he moved on to other things, or is he still in Durham?
Drew Adamek has moved on. He's he was always a busy dude. It's like he plopped in here, did a bunch of freelance work, worked with me on this. Last I heard, he's in Serbia. So he's that's the life of an investigative journalist.
Would you take on another cold case by yourself? Do you think that you've learned enough after? I mean, obviously you have the trust of the Durham police because they're talking to you about doing other cases. Is this something that you want to do on your own, or would you like to have a partner on it?
We've been having this conversation for the last couple of days, and I would like to work. I enjoyed working with somebody, bouncing ideas. You know, when things started coming up, it would be like midnight or something. I'm up and just, I'd get into a little K-hole investigating things on the internet or looking through old newspapers or whatever. And then finally, when you find that little needle in the haystack, you want to call somebody. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, my wife gets tired of hearing about murder all night long. So, like, you know, you want to make that phone call that, dude, I finally found it. Oh my God, this is amazing. Guess where it was? And look at it, you know, and like, there were those moments that just kept happening. And so I definitely need some of that. And it's hard. It really is hard. So it's good to have a partner. And then plus, as anybody listening to my voice sounds, you know, can tell right now is that you can't really listen to me narrate a thing for a full hour. You need somebody with a little levity to come in and help me out.
Well, I don't know. I think you're pretty funny. maybe you need a straight man is what you need, Eric. You need the straight man.
Yeah, I don't think they want the funny guy telling murder stories.
Well, you know.
But thank you.
But you're a brilliant writer on this. So, you know, you've got
thank
to
you.
Do it again. And I would imagine, do you think that you'll have fiction coming from this? Do you think you'll have fiction stories because of this investigation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I still block off like 3 hours a day to work on fiction stuff. The advantage of this, one of the great things that came out of this, well, one of them, of course, is, you know, Major Tim Horn has been very, very supportive. After our work on this, he's arranged a ride along with the deputies. I'm actually going tomorrow. He's allowed me to see how law enforcement works, which has been great because, as you mentioned, my previous books, it's mostly all criminals because that's what I know. You know, I've known more criminals all my entire life. So this has been, you know, I've never really written about cops because I don't understand everything they do. And so this has been invaluable, is that now I get to see what kind of work law enforcement guys do, or how, you know, you would investigate a murder, particularly a cold case murder. And it's just absolutely fascinating. Working with police, I think Richard Price said it best. You know, it's a backstage pass. You're getting a backstage view of all the action.
I'm sure that they're pretty happy that you actually asked to take on this case. Were you assigned any resources from the Durham Police Department?
Our work was with the Orange County Sheriff's Office.
Because that's who caught
the murder. Durham police have been very, very cooperative. Sergeant Pyatt over at Durham has been very, very cooperative and helpful and encouraging with everything. But it's the brunt of it's been on Orange County. So that's who we've been working with. I hope I haven't gotten on their nerves too much. So, but they've been great.
Well,
absolutely,
if they've asked
great.
You back, you probably didn't, you know, so that's a good thing. I want to mention Eric's books, most recently What We Reckon, and then Townies, which will be out in October. You can find Eric on the web at Eric, E-R-Y-K, Pruitt. He calls himself a storyteller, and that he is. He definitely is a storyteller. You can also find the entire Long Dance podcast on Libsyn, but you can just Google it and the page will pull up and you can listen to the episodes from beginning to end. Do not plan on going anywhere. It is a fascinating, fascinating listen. Eric, thanks so much for being with me. I've really enjoyed this. I know I'm going to see you at BoucherCon, and I hope that whether you see the number one suspect in your mind before or after BoucherCon, I do hope you'll come back and tell me about it.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime. I love talking to you, even when it's not on the radio, even if it's just a late night BS session.
And we do that enough, don't we?
Pour a drink and talk to Pam.
There you go. We're going to be at BoucherCon on Saturday morning. We have a panel, Stick These in Your Ears, and it's about podcasting. We're going to have a lot of fun because there's not a one of us who's real serious on that panel. Poor Kate. Fortunately, she isn't either. She's a panel moderator. There's going to be giveaways, and I'm sure we're going to have food because that's just who we are. I'm going to be doing – that's okay. You don't have to. I'm bringing. and also we're going to be doing a live remote. So authors who are there, please find us. We did a gaggle up at Thriller Fest with 30 A-list authors. It was a ton of fun. And thanks again, Eric Pruitt. You're the best, my friend.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Eric, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks for listening, everybody, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Have a great day. I'll be back at 6 o'clock with a debut novelist, Deborah Stevens.